WHO is very concerned over the evolving situation in China, with increasing reports of severe disease. In order to make a comprehensive risk assessment of the situation on the ground, WHO needs more detailed information on disease severity, hospital admissions, and requirements for ICU support.
The World Health Organization's Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus speaking earlier today in Geneva. After 3 years of strict COVID rules, China abruptly ended its zero COVID policy earlier this month. The virus was contained, but at a big price. Entire cities were locked down. People were essentially prisoners inside their own homes. And of course, the world economy suffered. Well, now that those restrictions are gone, the virus appears to be running loose. Hospitals are overflowing. Crematoriums are operating around the clock. So how far and how fast will the virus spread? Ali Mokhtad is here to answer that. He's an epidemiologist at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, China is reporting 1,800 cases a day. And so that seems really low. By comparison, just here in L.A. County, we are seeing around 3,000 cases a day. So why is that number so low?
It's very low. Many of the infections with Omicron, we know from what happened elsewhere, about 75% of them are asymptomatic one. And China has cut down the number of tests, so that's why they're underreporting the true number of cases in the country.
Right. Okay. And they're only reporting 7 deaths since the restrictions were lifted. So what do you think? You do modeling. What do you think the real number is?
That's an underestimate of deaths. Again, as usual, Chinese are not reporting the total numbers of deaths. So there's much more mortality. And also China has changed the number, the way they define the COVID-19 deaths. They only attribute COVID-19 deaths to pneumonia and respiratory diseases. So anybody dying from COVID-19, from a heart condition, they will assign it to a heart condition. Right now, what we are estimating in the country is about 17,000 deaths a day.
17,000 deaths a day. And so if that continues at that pace, what do you think is going to happen? How many deaths total before the virus begins to abate?
We're expecting about 500,000 deaths by April 1st and about 1.6 million deaths by the end of the year if they don't put any mandates in place. If they put mandates in place, that number will come down to 1.2 million by the end of the year and to 300,000 by April 1st.
Still, 1.2 million, that is extraordinary.
That's a lot of deaths. Simply because of the success of the zero COVID policy, many Chinese are susceptible. And we have Omicron and its subvariant that's highly contagious and is spreading so fast.
And it's spreading mainly, as I understand it, in the elderly, people over the age of 80, because so few of them have gotten their booster shots.
Exactly. So many of them are not even vaccinated. So above 80, it's about 40% who have been vaccinated, and not only booster on vaccines. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're seeing them being most vulnerable right now in China.
And why haven't they gotten their vaccines? They are the most vulnerable.
Unfortunately, in China, especially among the elderly population, there is this disbelief in Western medication and more belief in traditional medication. And that's why the uptake of the vaccine has been very low in that age group.
And then the vaccine is a Chinese-made vaccine, which is not using the mRNA technology and is less effective, right?
Of course. They're using a version of the vaccine that was designed for the Wuhan, and it's less effective than the vaccines we are using here in the West or in the United States. And so far, they have been reluctant to accept mRNA vaccine and to use it among the most vulnerable population.
So what will they do? Are they, as far as you can tell, just going to let the virus just run rampant and burn out?
No, they wouldn't. What we are monitoring right now is hospitalization. Mm-hmm. And I believe that they will hit the brakes so fast if hospitalization becomes a big problem for them. And right now what we hear from reports, they're very close to the 80% capacity.
So by hit the brakes, what does that mean? Reimpose some of the lockdown policies?
Yes, reimpose, not zero COVID, but reimpose mandates like what we did here in California and in Washington by saying non-essential, please stay at home, mask, COVID-19 is spreading, you need to put your better quality mask and you need to stay at home.
Well, would they ever import some of the mRNA vaccines and the antiviral medication?
They will. Eventually, they will, especially if a higher percentage of deaths is occurring among the elderly. They'll be more receptive. Right now, it's a national pride that their vaccine, you know, they made their own vaccine. But we know that they have been trying to manufacture themselves antiviral and mRNA vaccines.
And what is the likelihood that then the virus will mutate into something else because it is infecting so many people and start to migrate to other parts of the world?
It's very possible. We know with this virus, if you allow it to spread, it will mutate. But the good news, I mean, there is nothing good about COVID-19. But so far from what we have seen with Omicron, over 3 billion infection worldwide, and all the sub-variants that came about are still not immune escape variant. By immune escape variant, I mean a variant that makes the vaccines less effective. The vaccines we are using in the U.S., so far we haven't seen it. And hopefully that will be the case in China as well.
Okay, so here in this country, what are you going to be looking for as the holiday season progresses?
This virus is seasonal, and right now in this country, coupled with flu and RSV, we're seeing a rise of cases that we have expected in our projections. But it will not pose a major danger for us in the country simply because 98% of us in the United States have been infected at least once, and many of us have been vaccinated. I wish that we had a higher rate of boosters, but we are in a better position than China right now.
All right. Well, I want to thank you very much, and happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you. Bye.
Thank you. That's Ali Mokhtad. He's an epidemiologist at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. Coming up, why 90s TV psychic Miss Cleo became a star and then disappeared. A new documentary finds out who she was. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. If you channel surfed late at night in the late 90s and early 2000s, you really couldn't escape one unmistakable voice.
Miss Cleo!
As a shaman,
what will you ask me?
Who seek the knowledge?
Don't go blindly through life.
Don't you really want to
power up the tarot?
Then you gotta stop accepting the booty calls.
It's amazing what Miss Cleo can see.
The cards can reveal things that you will never see by your
free. Call now for a free tarot.
Call me for your free reading.
Call me now for your free tarot reading.
Call me now, of course. Miss Cleo, the TV psychic who'd read tarot cards and predict your future by phone for a mere $4.99 a minute. She was the face of an infomercial empire, the Psychic Readers Network. She was also an enigma. Few people knew anything about Miss Cleo, where she was from, what her real name was, whether or not the accent was a real Jamaican accent. And then, after the Federal Trade Commission busted the Psychic Network for deceptive practices, she vanished from late-night cable as quickly as she had appeared. Miss Cleo died of cancer in 2016. She was just 53 years old. Celia Aniskovich tells her story in a new documentary. It's called Call Me Miss Cleo. It's streaming now on HBO Max. Celia, welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Well, did you watch Miss Cleo? Is that why you were drawn to telling her story?
Oh, gosh, totally. I mean, it was hard to avoid Miss Cleo when she was at her height, right? Which was, she came on the airwaves in 97 and was on till the early 2000s. And I think anyone who was up late at night surfing the channels saw Miss Cleo and remembered her. But what I find is she's sort of one of those memories that we've forgotten about. You know, you say Miss Cleo to someone immediately, they go, oh, yeah, I'd forgotten about her. But she's sort of in that part of our brain that we lock away. And part of the impetus for wanting to make this film was thinking, you know, Miss Cleo was such a part of our sort of cultural consciousness, and yet I don't know a single thing about Miss Cleo or the real woman herself. And so I thought, okay, if I don't know more here, that probably means there is more here, and let me see what digging I can do.
But she really stood out from all the other psychics, right? I mean, she had the accent, she had like the set where she looked like, I don't know, some wild woman who had some secret knowledge that other people wouldn't have.
She did. And we go into this in the film because, you know, the Psychic Readers Network, which is who she worked for, had many hosts before Cleo, and they didn't catch on in the same way. So it wasn't just about what she was offering. It was about how she was offering it, who she was, what she looked like. And there was just something about Cleo, something that made you say, I've got to call this woman. I've got to figure out what it is. She was captivating. And I think almost anyone you ask, regardless of their feelings of Cleo, agree on that. If there's a lot of things people don't agree about when it comes to Miss Cleo, that's something that just about everyone can agree on.
Yeah, she's a star. She was she had the thing on TV. Whatever it is.
Yes, the thing. Exactly.
The thing. Right. She had that. Okay, so you found out who she really was. Her name isn't Miss Cleo. She was born in Los Angeles. What was her real name?
Urie Del Harris was her name on her birth certificate. The earliest period we're able to track her back to was when she went to an all-girls boarding school in Los Angeles, Ramona Convent. And from there, we're sort of able to track her life. Unfortunately, Miss Cleo isn't still around to answer additional questions. At the time, she would claim that, you know, that birth certificate was forged, that she was adopted from Jamaica. One of the interviewees in our film says it best, you know, that's not necessarily the logical explanation. The logical explanation is that she was born in LA and created this character, Miss Cleo. But then again, you know, when it comes to Cleo, I never say for certain anything because she continually surprises me over and over.
Well, you tracked down some people she worked with in Seattle when she was working at a community theater there, the Langston Hughes Theater. And they were shocked when they saw her on TV. And I'm just going to play a clip of tape from your documentary about when they first saw her on TV, years after she had left the Langston Hughes Theater.
I do remember hearing the voice and looking up and seeing her face and basically going, oh, shit. It kind of was this trickle down of, did you see? Did you heard of Miss Cleo?
That's her.
You heard about Ray and what she's doing. She's doing this Jamaican accent role on TV, and she's telling people's fortunes.
It was a shock, like having the TV on and looking up and being like, what the hell?
So she was going by the name Ray Perry at the theater. And she came up with that character of Miss Cleo while she was working in the theater?
While she was working at the theater, yeah. I think, you know, our interviews with the people at Langston in Seattle were some of the most important, I think, in the film, because they really are the origin story of Miss Cleo. And she went by Cleo for the rest of her life after Miss Cleo. Everyone who knew her after her Miss Cleo days, she continued to speak with a Jamaican accent for the remainder of her life. But those in Seattle will tell you, you know, she didn't have that accent when she was there. She, you know, they weren't sure where she was from, but they said, we definitely didn't think she was from Jamaica. You know, she didn't have that accent. But she was, as they describe her, larger than life and really great at creating these characters and putting on sort of these big performances. And that is sort of where the person we all came to know was born. And so it was a really important part of our story.
Okay, so let's get to when she was Miss Cleo at her height. And she was dispensing this advice, so people would call in to this 1-800 or 1-900 number, and you would hear them on TV, and she would do a tarot card reading and talk to them about, I guess, their love life or something, or their money problems. And she would actually have really good advice, right? Or she would be able to connect with them in a way that maybe other people weren't able to, and talk to them about, I don't know, about things that no one would know about. And she actually seemed like the real deal. If there is such a thing as a real deal when it comes to a psychic.
There is such a thing, right?
Yeah. Big caveat.
Yes. So most people who called, and one of our contributors says this in the film, call for one of two reasons, money or honey, money or love. And most people who called Miss Cleo, I think this is the thing that a lot of people do realize. It makes sense, right? When you think about it, Miss Cleo can't be answering everyone's calls. But what does that actually mean? Sometimes you got one of the hundreds, maybe thousands of workers who were picking up her calls. But Cleo, if you did get her, I'd love to know how many people actually got Cleo, was there to read your cards, to tell you what she thought might happen. And she often did that live on air. And we always knew going into this, some people believe that psychics are real and some people don't, just fundamentally. And so if you don't believe that any of this is possible, you're not going to believe anything I'm about to say. But for those who do believe that this is even possible, we heard story after story of Cleo predicting things correctly, of Cleo going completely off script and getting things right, of Cleo shocking even the most fervent unbeliever. And so it was really fascinating to sort of hear these stories of not just a woman who was a really great actress, who was great at putting on a voice, who was great at creating a character, but a woman who maybe did have something there that was more than just, you know, the entertainment thing that caught our eye.
So you mentioned something that is key to this whole enterprise, and that is all of the people who were answering the calls. And you interview some of them, and they said that they were really instructed to keep people on the phone as long as possible, right? As they were paying by the minute. And these people had no counseling experience or anything related to any kind of ability to really talk to people who were in trouble or who were looking for advice. So that seems very suspect and possibly dangerous.
No, absolutely. And I think for all of the people that we talked to, there was a moment for each of them where what started as sort of a funny joke or a quick way to make some money very quickly became something that they questioned the morals and ethics of. But I also think that most of the people who worked for the network that I talked to came from a place of truly wanting to help people.
So what would they say, for example?
They had to get everyone's phone numbers and addresses so they could follow up also with more mailers, right, to please call back. They'd sometimes put people on hold and say, let me try to go find Miss Cleo. Let me find Miss Cleo for you. But it was always this sense of, you know, just stay with me and, keep listening. And, oh, the cards aren't quite clear yet, but I'm seeing something. And it was, you know, a classic sort of
scam,
leading questions and scam. Yeah. I mean, it was a scam, but there was an enormous lawsuit. And, you know, I think all of these people are somewhat ashamed for the part they played in the scam. But equally, I think that goes to something that we tried to do in the film as well, which is make clear the difference between the people who were pawns in the scam and the masterminds of the scam.
So who were the masterminds?
Oh, well, there were two men living in South Florida at the time who ran the operation. And they were sued eventually by the FTC and forced to close down the whole operation. That said, they made millions of dollars from this scam. And they were not alone. There were lots of different kind of psychic call centers at the time. And one of the things that I found really interesting about being scammed is it's the one crime where scammers often get away with it because there's such a sense of shame that people feel over being scammed that they almost don't want to admit that it happened to them. Mm-hmm. Because you feel as though, you know, oh God, I was too naive or too dumb or I shouldn't have been scammed. And that's how people get away with it. So, you know, another part of this for us was also sort of holding truth to power here and saying, you know, if you ask your average person on the street, you know, who is Miss Cleo, they'd say, oh, that scammer who scammed people out of millions of dollars. And, you know, we grapple with the question of how much responsibility does Miss Cleo hold. But I think it's also important for the world to know that she was in many ways the fall guy. She was the front person for a whole large fraudulent operation.
Did she make money, a lot of money off it?
So this is one of the other very sad aspects of this story. Cleo was paid roughly, I think she says in the film, $1,700 for the first commercial she did. Mm. This is not a woman who was rolling in cash.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So people would think, oh, she's the one who was swindling me because she's the one who was on TV. But also, I'm wondering if that's the other side to this kind of friendly Jamaican character that she played, that people were then, oh, I see. So actually this person can't be trusted. And it's part of that, like, oh, a foreigner who is swindling Americans. Did people feel that way?
It's interesting. You know, I think there was certainly an element to, and we go into this in depth in the film, and I think it's one of the most important parts of the film is this image that they created of her. You know, and we have an interview, one of Cleo's last interviews before she died in the film, where Cleo talks about how they asked her to, you know, dial the accent up and you know, overplay this idea of this sort of Jamaican Shango shaman.
They wanted me to appear like I had just arrived on the scene straight out of bush. Well, that wasn't the case. I was educated. I actually had a higher up tell me one time, well, don't tell them you went to an all-girl boarding school. They said, no. You know, it's all right. You can use a little patois. Let's see how. And they would tell me, dial it up. You know, dial it up. You're getting too passive. We want you more animated. You know, and I'm animated enough. Trust this. You're trying to create a character. I'm not a character. I'm a real person.
And there's a lot to unpack in that statement for sure. But I do think that actually the Jamaican identity helped at least Americans believe her and not say that that's why they were swindled. I actually think this sort of exoticism was what allowed American callers to say, oh yes, she must know so much more than me. If you talk to any Jamaican, they'll tell you they knew right away.
That she wasn't Jamaican?
Yes, yes.
Well, you do talk to a woman who's an expert in Caribbean studies, Andrea Nevins. And let me just play a clip of tape from her when she as she analyzes the character that Cleo portrayed.
So there were things about her race, I would say even her size and her gender, that helped to make it believable that she was associated with the fantastic. She's sort of progeny of Mammy in some ways, and the Mammy figure. There was a level of comfort that the owners of the psychic network needed customers to have. And the Mammy figure has historically, though problematically, been a figure that provides nurturing to the white community.
That's so interesting. And do you think that she consciously played into that?
I think that the network asked her to play into that for sure.
Yeah.
I think, you know, one of the other things that has come about since the film has been released is people sort of talking about the difference between how white audiences and Black audiences, both African-American and Caribbean audiences, view her differently. And, you know, I don't know to what degree, and everyone has their own opinions, but it's certainly a question that we raised in the film, and the Langston people who you played in the beginning of this bring up towards the end of our film of, you know, I think it's Jasmine who says it's a lot easier to convince white people of all sorts of things.
Yeah. But the end result is a lot of people lost a lot of money in this whole scam.
A lot of people lost a lot of money. And yeah, I think that's one of the saddest elements of this. But I also think, you know, we wanted to approach this film with a desire to, again, tell a more three-dimensional story of both mm-hmm. of both Cleo and of everything that happened. And so my hope, you know, I saw someone said recently, it's a little bit like a cautionary tale to not always believe everything you're fed and ask some questions, both on the, you know, not always believing that the front person is the mastermind, but also not always believing that I should maybe make that call because, you know, thinking about how I might get scammed. And so I'm glad that there are a lot of different and varying lessons that people seem to be taking from the film.
Well, it's really an entertaining and poignant look at Miss Cleo. And thank you so much for making the movie.
Thank you for having me on to talk about it. It's been great.
My pleasure. That's Celia Aniskovich, one of the directors and producer of the new documentary, Call Me Miss Cleo. It's about the rise and fall of the 1990s TV psychic, streaming now on HBO Max. Coming up, we'll revisit one of our favorite interviews of the year with Mexican singer Silvana Estrada.
In my hometown, you can be singing and dancing, and then you can have like 20 people playing around, you know, because it's a party, so everybody brings their own instruments.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
He perdido tantas veces que inevitable es el recuerdo.
That's Marchita by the singer-songwriter Silvana Estrada. It's the title track from her debut solo album that was released earlier this year. Marchita means withered in Spanish. She wrote it after a painful breakup. Well, the album is one of KCRW's best of the year. So as we close out 2022, let's revisit my conversation with Silvana Estrada from back in March when I asked her about her musical beginnings and what led her to study jazz in college in Mexico.
You know, I grew up listening to Miles Davis. My parents both are musicians, so I grew up with a lot of music. And I think, I don't know, I remember being like 12 or 11, listening to Chet Baker or Sarah Vaughan or Ella Fitzgerald and going like crazy about it. Like, huh. There is something in some records that just cross my chest. And most of those records are, I don't know, from the 60s or sometimes the 40s. So, yeah.
Well, speaking of jazz, you, for your previous album, your 2017 album, Lo Sagrado, which means the sacred, you made this with American guitarist Charlie Hunter.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
How did you two meet and decide to collaborate?
Well, that's a really beautiful story. I was studying jazz and I went to this festival in Guadalajara. I think Charlie was teaching this like masterclass. And my friends, they were like, dude, you should actually like show him your music. And I was like, no, like I do songs. I do like really folkloric, like 2-3 chords. And, you know, I was also studying jazz. And for me, it was like, no, this music is so complicated. Like I cannot just stand here and present my music, like my really, really simple music. And, but, you know, my friends, they convinced me and he was like, dude, this is amazing. I love this.
He called you dude?
Yeah, yeah. He still do that.
He still does.
Yeah, he does. And at the end of the festival, the seminary, he texted me like, hey, we should record an album together. And I was like, yeah, sure, let's do it. And he came to my hometown, to Coatepec, and we recorded Lo Sagrado in my parents' house. Wow. It's a really like home record, you know?
Yeah, so not in a studio.
Yeah, yeah, no at all. Actually, like the biggest problem with the album is that the reverb was so close that all the album is like, there's like a little bit sound of reverb. And that, at the end, we were like, wow. Okay, there's nothing we can do about it. Let's just ignore it.
That's nice, the sound of the river.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit from the title track. Here is Lo Sagrado.
sus pies algún milagro se fue.
So, rough translation, who is going to save her of this loneliness? Yes, when you stop walking, the sea floods it. What are you singing about there?
You know, for me, like sometimes as an artist, I travel so much that it's almost like I'm hiding from something, you know? And it's kind of that feeling of, you know, who's going to save me of this loneliness that you can actually get when you travel so much. If every time that I stop, I feel the rush of being on the road again, what I can understand and or what resonates mm-hmm. with me, it's that idea of being lonely but never actually being somewhere enough to actually be with somebody, no?
Yeah. So like running away from the loneliness, but then that also contributing to the loneliness.
Yeah. Yeah. It's complicated.
Yeah. Well, let's play another song that talks about that a little bit, what you're getting at. And I think maybe we can talk about this more. It's called Casa, which means home. And it's off your new album. So here's a bit of that.
Mi casa es una estrella que se apaga. Qué triste se despide de mi voz. Qué triste se despide de mi voz.
Beautiful, absolutely gorgeous. And
thank you.
Talk a little bit about how you made that song and the album, the instruments involved.
Well, that special song for me, it's like, I mean, right now it's my favorite song from the album Marchita, and it's a song about homesick, and it's a song about I did this song for my parents because I miss them so much, and being far from home and actually knowing that everything is changing, but I'm not there to actually see how it's changing, you know, how my parents are getting mm-hmm. older, how my garden, how the river, it's changing, you know. And it was so important for us to keep it like simple, you know,
yeah.
even if the feeling is so, I don't know, dark at some point. So we started recording like noises from the kitchen and from the garden and doors, and then like a piano but far, far, far away, and then a saxophone but far, 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 far away. So it was like a construction, almost like theatrical construction of a house. And it's like at the end all the sounds become in this beautiful arrangement for a quartet of strings, and that mm-hmm. that also for me makes a lot of sense because I grew up in a family of luthiers. My parents, my mom and my dad, they do violins and violas and double basses and cello. So it was so important to me to also have that type of instrumentation. And, you know, I'm trying to honor where I come from.
So your parents, you say, are luthiers and they made all sorts of strings. Instruments. Did you grow up playing those instruments?
Yeah, not all of them, but I grew up playing a violin and viola, yeah.
And you also play the cuatro?
I do. That's actually the only instrument that I can say that I actually play, because I stopped with the violin and the viola when I was like 12 or 13. I was rebel. Didn't want to anymore.
Oh, you rebelled?
Yeah.
So by focusing on your voice and your singing, is that a form of rebellion?
Well, in my experience, yes, a little bit. Because my parents, they build instruments for me. That's like a lot of pressure, you know, when your parents, they do like a double bass and a cello and a violin and a viola just for you. at some point I was like, okay, guys, I don't want this. Like, I don't like this. I just want to do like songs. I didn't knew. I just started singing, and then the cuatro came to my life when I needed it the most. So yeah, now I'm playing the cuatro, and you know, my dad, he was like, pero mi hija, no. You know?
Yeah, he doesn't like the cuatro?
No, like I guess now they do, but you know, at the beginning they were like, no, but we can do like a guitar for you. We can do like a baroque guitar for you. And I was like, no, I like this instrument. It's only 4 string, you know. Yeah. I love the sound, and now they love it.
Okay, well, let's rebel a little bit and hear this next song, which is really showing off your voice. It's called Sabré Olvidar, which means I'll learn to forget.
Yeah.
Sabré olvidar, porque el silencio no da opción cuando uno canta, y este dolor se ha de esfumar en mi garganta. Sabré olvidar, sabré olvidar. Aunque ahora cargue la desgracia entre mis dientes, pues sonreír.
So when you're creating a song and thinking about how you should arrange it, how do you think about where you want to showcase the instruments and where you want to showcase your voice? Because in this one, your voice is very forward.
Yeah. For me, it was like, okay, this is a song that we need to show the strength, but also the sweetness of it. And this song, it's a song about strength, you know. It's a song about I will learn how to forget you, you know. Mm-hmm. So I started only by myself with my cuatro, and then I start to add the percussion and then the double bass, and then the climax is this moment where all the instruments are together. But even in the climax, I use my voice to be louder. That's also something really important to me, and something that you can see especially in the Latin American folklore, because most of the times when we sing folklore, we don't have microphones, you know, that's modern. And, yeah, you know, in my hometown, you can be singing and dancing, and then you can have like 20 people playing around, you know, because it's a party. So everybody brings their own instruments and everybody's like playing, and you need to sing loudly enough to be heard. So I wanted to keep that energy and that power all along the album, actually, like the power of that you can have in your own voice. No,
right? So you really have to learn how to belt it out and not be shy. You can't rely on the microphone.
Yeah, exactly. I really like to talk about folklore because it's so like the act of singing in those environments, you know, with a lot of guitar, a lot of men, you know, it's also like really male kind of energy. It takes so much braveness and strength that I really wanted to defend that in this album.
I love that you call it bravery to sing loudly.
Yeah, definitely is.
It has been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for coming on the show today.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much. Muchísimas gracias.
De nada. Silvana Estrada, her debut album is called Marchita.
Y ahora piensas diferente, te guardo mi luz de mañana, mis ojos, mi amor y mi alma.
Coming up, how to throw a great cocktail party. The director, Paul Fee, gives us ideas for holiday drinks. That's next on Press Play. Tengo el espacio carente que ocuparía tu abrazo si se nos diera el caso. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Paul Feig is best known for directing big hits like Bridesmaids, the Ghostbusters remake, and creating the TV show Freaks and Geeks. But during the pandemic, Feig took up another career of sorts, mixologist. During lockdown, he made drinks on a nightly Instagram live show he called Quarantine Cocktail Time.
It's me. It's your drunk funkle. It's your favorite drunk funkle. Your favorite drunk funkle? Maybe not. It's your drunk funkle. And it's so much fun Saturday. It's so much fun Saturday. Why is it so much fun? Because you're going to get up and get ready, because this is the Saturday song that's going to launch you into the weekend. Guarda come dondolo,
guarda come dondolo. All right. Well, Paul Feig has turned his recipes into a book. It's called Cocktail Time, The Ultimate Guide to Grown-Up Fun. And Paul Feig joins me now to talk about it and to share some tips for hosting a proper holiday cocktail party. Hello.
Hello, Madeline. It's so great to be here. I'm such a fan of the show.
Oh, I'm a fan of yours. Should I call you Drunk Funkle for the rest
Please
of the
do.
Interview?
Please do. Everybody else does.
How's your liver? I'm a little concerned.
Weirdly, it's actually really good. Every time I go to the doctor, I'm like waiting for the news. He's like, oh, no, you're fine. So, okay. Good.
So, carry like, on.
High-end booze, I guess.
So how did you decide to do this during the pandemic? Were you just super bored and drinking a lot and you thought, hey, entertainment?
Yeah, I was shooting a pilot in North Carolina, and we had obviously had to shut down. And the day I came back, I was just sitting there going like, well, we're going to be sitting around for possibly a lot of months. And I wanted to help out somehow. And I'm not a medical professional, so I can't do that. But I thought, well, you know, I can try to raise money for charities, and we'll try to make people laugh, because I do comedies and that's my lot in life. So I have all these old cocktail books, and I love cocktails, but I always kind of wanted to teach myself how to do it more in depth, and thought, well, I'll just go on the air and learn how to do it in front of everybody and make a fool of myself while I do.
Did you have the old standby? Is it called Mr. Boston or something like that? That red book?
Yeah, I love Mr. Boston, which weirdly went out of print about 10 years ago. And it was, you know, ubiquitous in every bar. Yeah, I've got other books, but Mr. Boston is the king.
The Bible. All right. Well, before we get into some of the drinks,
yes.
Tell us, what is the recipe for a perfect cocktail party? What do you need before you even think about the cocktail itself?
It's really about the pageantry and the kind of the fun of a cocktail party, because a cocktail party, I say in the book, is not like a regular party. Cocktail parties are more about conversation and getting a group of people who sometimes don't know each other, but you know, will have things in common and can get to know each other. And then kind of having a dress code. It doesn't have to be fancy. I mean, I personally really love like a formal black tie cocktail party, but it can be anything. You just have to let people know sort of what the theme and the mode of dress is. Then you have to pick the right music, have it on kind of soft in the background, so it's not competing with the conversation. And then you just have beautiful drinks and beautiful glasses and beautiful people there talking and getting along. And it's super fun.
Oh my gosh. It sounds like something from another era. It sounds so civilized.
That's always my goal. I mean, I see those pictures of those old, you know, Truman Capote parties. Oh, and when I say beautiful people, I do not mean physically beautiful. I mean, just beautiful, you know, personalities and souls there. Because that's really what it's all about. It's about that intermixing and getting to know new people.
Okay, so let's talk about the drinks. Let's get to the main meat of this interview, if you will. And let's begin simple.
Yes.
And simple is a martini, because it's basically just straight booze, right? So tell us about the Duke's Martini. It's a hotel in London, and you say they make the best martini.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm very partial to Duke's Bar. It's where Ian Fleming is reported to have discovered the martini. And what's great about what they do there, they make a very strong martini there, because what they do is they freeze the gin in the bottle. They freeze the glasses. Alessandro Palazzi, the head bartender, who's amazing, wheels a wooden cart out next to your table, takes this frozen glass, puts a few drops of vermouth in the glass, swirls it around to coat the edges, and then throws the vermouth onto the carpet. And then he takes the frozen gin, pours it in straight up, and then gets a big Amalfi Coast lemon, cuts a giant twist, expresses the twist over the top, skin first, so you get a nice blast of lemon oil on there, and then kind of rubs the edges with the twist, drops it in, and you have what is a really perfect martini, but a real butt kicker, if you will.
Well, I guess it's not in one of those bird bath glasses. It's a pretty small glass, comparatively speaking.
No, always like a 4 ounce glass. Yeah, no. I mean, as I say in the book, the bane of our existence is the 10 ounce martini, which has become more and more popular. It's like the big gulp of straight gin or vodka, if you must, when you do a martini. And that's a third of a bottle of alcohol. Oof. So, you know, so either you're going to, if you want to keep it cold, you have to either just, you know, chug the whole thing, which is terrible, or it just gets warm as you sit there. But a 4 ounce martini is very civilized because you can sip it, you can kind of keep it going, especially if the glass was frozen to start with. And it just, you know, you don't want to wreck yourself before dinner.
Right, exactly. What is one of your favorites that you invented recently?
It's a dessert drink called the Michigan Bonbon, which, but our great Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin was doing a fundraiser, and I always support her, and she wanted to do kind of a Zoom during the lockdown, a Zoom cocktail party fundraiser. And so I invented this drink, which is, it's basically, it's got espresso in it. It's got creme de cacao, which gives it a chocolatey flavor. But then I put in cherry hearing, which is like a cherry liqueur. Mm. And then you put in heavy cream. Look out if you're lactose intolerant. Get ready. And you shake that up, get it all frothy. And then you put some cinnamon on top. And it is delicious.
Sounds like dessert.
It is dessert. It's very much a dessert. I have a real love of dessert drinks. They are the most delightful drinks. I've never handed somebody one of those drinks where they haven't gone, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. So here's to the dessert drinks and to heavy cream.
Okay, let's just dive in and just go straight to eggnog then. Do you do anything with eggnog?
Well, actually, you know, I was just at a party and somebody weirdly requested cranberry eggnog, which I was like, okay, well, let's try to invent that. And so got some really high-end eggnog. I didn't make my own, I hate to admit, because that intimidates me. Cracking all those eggs into something. Yeah, totally. It's like making ice cream. You're like, I'd rather not know how the sausage is made, quite frankly. And so got fresh cranberries and put like 3 cups of eggnog into the blender and about a half a cup or actually about half the package of cranberries. And then put a pinch of salt in there to just kind of cut the sweetness a little bit. Mm-hmm. And ground it all up. And it was a crowd pleaser. Oh, and I put some brandy in there too. Yeah. Why would you not?
Right. Yeah. I was going to say, where's the booze and all that? But that sounds, exactly. That sounds really, really good. Mm, that sounds really simple. Okay. Let's end with like a super wackadoodle one.
This, I didn't invent this one, but this is my favorite drink in the book because it's a terrible drink. But the reason I put it in there is because it was a very popular drink during the disco age, and it is called a hot pants. If I tell you all the ingredients separately, you'll go, oh, those are delicious ingredients. You know, you've got tequila, grapefruit juice, then you've got some powdered sugar. So things start to go off the rails there. And then into the mix comes peppermint schnapps.
Oof.
Yes.
I know. Exactly. Okay, you lost me there, Paul.
Okay, well, I'm about to lose you even more because then you have to garnish the glass with a salt rim, okay? This is either going to be fantastic or a train wreck, and it was even more than a train wreck. It was a plane crash and everything else. My theory on why it was popular is I think everybody in those days was so whacked out on cocaine that they needed something to blast through whatever haze they were in. And this blast through.
Do you have any drink in this that's kind of a hangover avoider? So something a little less sugary? Yeah.
You know, there's drinks that aren't so alcoholic. I mean, I really love Americanos, which is just Campari and sweet vermouth and club soda. So it's almost a Negroni, but instead of gin, you just fill up with the rest with club soda. And it's a lovely sipping drink, you know. Mm-hmm. And when you go to, you know, Italy, that's what people have before dinner. They have these spritzes, and Americano is considered a spritz. And then the infamous Aperol spritz, mm-hmm. which, you know, has now become huge in our country. But my wife, Lori, and I had been going to Venice like from the early 90s. And I was like, what's that? It's Aperol. And we had to smuggle bottles back in our suit. It's great that it took off because it's such a lovely thing. You know, any kind of a spritz. I do make a limoncello spritz, and that does pack a punch because limoncello is basically rocket fuel that tastes like lemons.
Yeah, you have to, yeah, buyer beware, caveat emptor, yeah. with all this
exactly.
stuff.
Wade into it very carefully.
Okay, so this holiday, do you have a special holiday drink that you're making?
Well, actually, from that same party that brought us cranberry eggnog, but he wanted a peppermint espresso martini. I have in my book a recipe for an espresso martini, which are now hugely popular. I did my espresso recipe, which is basically espresso and Kahlua and then vodka. But then into that, I added like a half ounce of creme de menthe. Because I was going to try peppermint schnapps, and you can do peppermint schnapps too. That's just a little stronger, and it makes it really lovely. It's like, you know, it's a nice espresso-y, coffee-ish, chocolatey thing, but it's got a little bit of a little taste of Christmas in there.
Oh, well, that sounds wonderful. Well, thank you so much for sharing these recipes with us.
Thank you, Madeline. It's so much fun to talk to you all, and I hope everybody has an amazing holiday.
Yes, you too. That's director and producer Paul Feig. His new cocktail book is called Cocktail Time, The Ultimate Guide to Grown-Up Fun. All right, that'll do it for all the fun. No more fun left to have. That's it for us. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you tomorrow.